We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
The Crisis Next Door, a weekly report on the biggest conflicts around the world with host Jason Brooks.
Thanks for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. Massive demonstrations have gripped several countries recently, with streets filled with protesters in Hong Kong, Baghdad, Beirut, Barcelona, and Santiago, Chile. While those first four locations have received a fair amount of global scrutiny, Chile seems to have caught many by surprise. For more on why Chile has been racked with violent protests, we turn to John Bartlett, a journalist based in Santiago, writing for the UK's Guardian newspaper, the BBC, Washington Post, and others, and he's the co-host of Moradas, a podcast focusing on the politics, current events, and culture of Latin America. John, thank you for joining The Crisis Next Door.
Thanks very much for having me on.
When it comes to South America, at least from a North American perspective, Chile has long seemed one of the most stable countries on the continent, with relative affluence compared to several of its neighbors. But now we're seeing buildings burning, armored personnel carriers patrolling city streets. What has sparked these demonstrations, and has this been building for some time, or a sudden explosion of dissent?
Right, yeah, I think just to break that down, I think that your assessment of it as a stable country, I think that is certainly the case. I mean, that is, you know, I think it appears like that because it is stable, at least politically and economically as well. I think there's a lot of work has gone into building a system which is largely kind of unbreakable, untouchable, and I think that's partly where these demonstrations are coming from. I think that the kind of relative affluence, I think that's a good way of putting it. I think that there are parts of the country and parts of Santiago which are incredibly, incredibly affluent. I think that you go to certain kind of like the financial district, for example, in Santiago, and you could be in any major city in the world. It's the kind of CBD equivalent of any major city. In terms of what sparked these demonstrations, I think that all of the above. I think, as I'm sure we'll get onto later on, there was a metro fare rise, which affected the rush hour price of the metro. Here in Santiago, it raised it from 800 to 830 pesos, which is about, it was a 4% rise, and it equates to about $1.15 in the US dollar. So, I mean, it's one of the most expensive metro tickets in the region. But I think the real problem and the reason this was such an incredible kind of catalyst to ignite this kind of protest is the fact that it was simply it's such a massive proportion of people's income and people's disposable kind of people's liquidity in the country. I mean, people don't have enough money to spend so much on transport, for example. And I think that what really kind of got people going, I mean, this was on the 6th of October and things didn't really kick off until about the 19th of October, the Friday just gone. But kind of in that time, the economy minister came out and said, and I mean, almost kind of derisively really came out and said that people should just get up earlier to avoid this rush hour fare. And that's an incredible kind of, I'm not sure if it's a provocation. More than anything, it's just kind of being out of touch with the people. And like, you know, people travel huge distances across the capital to go to work from where they live. And it's just, I mean, it isn't practical, and it's just not helpful really to suggest that kind of thing.
That really seemed to strike Chile's student population in particular. Why do you think that is?
I think the Chile student body is potent. There was a massive protest in 2011, which was probably the last time that Chile really saw anything kind of, you know, verging on this scale. Even then, not as significant as this. And that very much involves students. Didn't really kind of transcend society as we're seeing at the moment. If you go out on the street now, people of all ages are there demanding all sorts of different things. I mean, there's a big drive towards addressing the pension system here in Chile, for example, to involve kind of the retired population here. And people are working into into old age, basically, and running up massive debts in order to pay basic costs. And it was just, I think this is something that's been coming for a long time, and it's difficult to break it down into its constituent parts, because I think there are just so many factors that have led to this. And I think that people have really moved on from this notion that it was the kind of metro fare that really sparked it, even though that was the kind of ostensible kind of moment that really kind of caught the headlines.
Are other groups joining the students, older Chileans perhaps?
Yeah, they are. Yeah, as I say, there's people kind of protesting for pension reform. It's a system which is, I mean, from those receiving the pensions, it's perceived to have failed in many ways. That's not always the perception outside the country and among kind of in economic circles. I think that in the same way that Chile is kind of perceived as this kind of great stable economy, I think that outside the country, if you look at these kind of very agreeable macroeconomic indicators, I think that if that's how you want to judge a country's progress and situation, then I think that Chile has rightly been described as a country that's doing well. But the reality on the street has never matched the kind of perceptions outside the country. And I think that's really what we're seeing now, that, you know, while people are surprised that this is happening, I don't think there's so much surprise here. And it really is surprising, I think, but certainly from my point of view, that some politicians were calling the kind of the outbreak of violence in particular, which I don't think is defensible. I think that that's kind of reducing this whole movement to something which it shouldn't really be. But people are saying that it's incomprehensible that this is turned into something so big. And I don't really think that's the case. I think that this was perhaps not foreseeable to this kind of this extent, but certainly has been coming for some time.
The violence seems to be increasing every day. The death toll seems to be rising, as well as the number of those injured or the number of those arrested. Is this really shocking the average Chilean that this is taking place in their country right now?
Yes, certainly. I think that Chile has, as I say, a kind of formidable civil society. Protests are common. People aren't afraid to go out into the streets and make their voices heard. The trouble is their voices aren't often heard. There are always a small minority. I don't think in every protest, but I've been to cover quite a few here in Santiago in particular, and often they turn violent in some parts. The repression is always quite heavy-handed when that does happen. So the death toll at the moment has risen to 18. That was announced this morning by the government. And I think over the last 24 hours, it's been 1,571 people have been arrested, which is, I mean, these are incredible numbers. I mean, this is a nationwide movement. I think the government figures as well said that across 54 marches in the whole of Chile yesterday, they said that 220,000 people had come out onto the streets. That's been disputed. I don't think it really matters. I think it's quite obvious kind of how many people are out on the streets, and you can see with the images. I mean, it's all over television here, and I imagine in other countries as well. But I think there's probably more than that. I think that's a very conservative estimate. But I mean, this really is something that's captured the imagination. The violence is something that the government has really sought to emphasize. They've tried to paint this as the acts of a small number of violent agitators in Chile, whereas I think the reality on the streets as well, and I think the government must know this, is not that. I mean, yes, there are parts of Santiago, there are parts of it in cities all across the country, which are experiencing these epidemics of looting and violence, and that's deplorable. That's not something that should really come with this movement, but you have to understand that the kind of the ire and the rage that's built up over such a long time has led people to go to these lengths. And I think that they see this kind of vandalism, which the government is really focusing on, as a way of kind of maybe even getting the state back. I mean, I'm not sure if I want to be quoted on that particularly, but I think that in some cases people really are just so angry that it's just kind of by any means by which they can protest, they are doing so.
You mentioned that the protests have spread beyond the capital. Are they just as strong in cities outside of Santiago, or is most of the, at least the violent protests, taking place in the capital?
Mm-hmm. So there have been a number of violent incidents around the country. Obviously, I'm in Santiago, so I can't comment necessarily on what's going on in other cities, but there have been huge demonstrations in the main kind of urban centres across Chile. And the other thing is that Chile is so centralised, kind of politically and economically and in every way, basically, that Santiago is always going to be the focus of these kind of protests. But that said, the other kind of urban centres of Antofagasta in the north, as far north as kind of Arica, which is on the Peruvian border, and Iquique, and down to Concepcion, kind of southern central part of the country, and even as far as kind of right down in the south in Magallanes, which is the kind of the final region before you get to the Chilean Antarctic region, there have been protests as well. I'm not entirely sure how much violence there's been and how it compares to Santiago, where I've been, but I think it's certainly indicative of the feeling that this isn't a kind of Santiago centric problem. This isn't kind of people seeing what's happening on the TV and joining in. I think people are really, really are angry. And I mean, as far as Easter Island as well, kind of right out in the South Pacific, you've it's a Chilean possession. You've seen people demonstrating as well. So this is something that really is uniting people. I mean, that's undeniable, I think, at this point.
Chilean President Sebastián Piñera has called up the military to help the riot police. Has there been any noticeable difference in how the armed forces handle the protesters compared to the riot police?
I think it's hard to differentiate, really. I think that the military really come into their role when the curfew starts, and that was last night. It started at 8 p.m. I think it was the same the night before, and 9 p.m. the night before that. So I think at that point, then the military are really taking to the streets. The Carabineros, the police force here in Chile, which is it was and perhaps still is in some ways one of the most respected institutions in Chile. In terms of the rule of law on the street, I think that Chileans have often felt far safer than in other countries. I mean, that reputation has now been eroded by kind of successive corruption allegations over the last few years. There have been some big scandals, and then this kind of dizzying kind of brutal reputation for repressing people at these demonstrations and just generally in the street. I think people are really starting to question how they view the Carabineros. I think they're maybe they're still feared. Certainly, I think that there's an enough kind of a monopoly on the rule of law and violence in Chile that people are willing to kind of do what they say. But that is something that you start to see questioned at times like these when there's a kind of mass civil movement. But I think that the alarming thing really with the military was just the speed and the ease with which President Piñera reached for them. He went kind of, it was almost the first thing he did. The first kind of reaction was to call the army onto the streets. And that was what really shocked a lot of people. I mean, this is obviously a country that, lest we forget, that is only kind of 30 years out. Well, it's 1973 when the dictatorship started, ended in 1990. And that was when we saw a lot of kind of military vehicles all over the streets in Santiago and throughout Chile. And they are painful memories for Chileans. I mean, this is, one of the first times since that we're really seeing we're really seeing the same thing again.
You just mentioned the Pinochet dictatorship, almost 30 years since it ended. Is there still a hangover for Chile after that 30 years later?
Yeah, definitely. I think that there's never really was any kind of reckoning with the dictatorship. Justice has been slow and non-existent in many cases. There are still thousands of people unaccounted for who have disappeared by the dictatorship, and no real kind of consensus on how to go about kind of honouring their memory and sorting out any kind of justice for the perpetrators of those crimes. I think that it's an interesting time, as I say, for people who are starting to see kind of the shadows of the dictatorship creep back in. But yeah, I think there's certainly a shadow of it. But Chile's still governed by the constitution that was written during the dictatorship. A lot of the model which is kind of in place at the moment and kind of governs how Chile works as a country was all ordained by rules and laws and the constitution that were all brought in under the dictatorship. So I think that in terms of legislation, that's probably the area where you see the most kind of the specter of the dictatorship still there. But obviously I think that the kind of physical signs are starting to reappear as well, and I think that's scaring a lot of Chileans.
You're listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks, and we're talking about the massive protests racking Chile with John Bartlett, a journalist based in Santiago, writing for the UK's Guardian newspaper, the BBC, the Washington Post, and others. And he's the co-host of Maradas, a podcast focusing on the politics, current events, and culture of Latin America. President Piñera said the country is at war with a violent enemy. That seems like an extreme declaration. How is that going over with the protesters and the average Chilean?
I think that was a clumsy thing to say. I think that would be fair to say. That again came very early in these protests. I think that was the second night, his second address. So it came around very quickly. It is worth saying as well that by the next morning, so Piñera said that the night, one evening, and then by the next morning, the head of the armed forces, General Iturriaga, had basically said that he said he was an hombre feliz, like a kind of a happy man, basically, and that he wasn't at war with anybody. So I think that there's been kind of widespread condemnation of that. You see a lot of the kind of placards and signs that people are carrying in the streets saying that we're not at war with anybody. You declared war on us, that kind of rhetoric. So I don't think anyone has really ascribed to that notion. And President Piñera hasn't repeated that. So I think that was probably something that didn't go down too well, and I think scared a lot of kind of observers as well in international circles, which I think is quite an important factor for this government as well.
It's interesting that Piñera suspended the metro fare hike, but that did not stop the demonstrations. In some ways, very similar to Hong Kong's months-long protests, which were sparked by a controversial extradition bill to China, which was then rescinded, but the protests have continued unabated. Do you think Piñera and his government were surprised the fare suspension did not quell the protests?
I don't think they should have been. I think that was fairly clear that wasn't the issue, and perhaps it was worth them trying as a first attempt to see if that, you know, kind of test the waters and see if that would reduce the protest to any extent. But I think what happened was more or less the opposite. I think that people kind of saw that and thought, you know, you're not understanding our demands. You're not understanding why we're on the streets. This isn't about a metro fare rise. I think obviously in practical terms it would have helped. I think that's, you know, that's something that people obviously were asking for from the early days of this movement, but it was never about a metro fare rise. And I think that while it was inevitable that he was going to have to repeal that in some way, and I think it's also worth saying that I think that what he said was that the law is going to change, that he wants to change the law, and then which will work towards kind of taking that fare rise back. So it wasn't a kind of outright immediate scrapping of that metro fare rise, but that might have changed in the meantime. I haven't really been keeping up with that, as the movement's kind of moved on so quickly from the kind of the metro protests.
Does it appear that Piñera will be willing to compromise elsewhere to try and assuage the protesters?
Yeah, so last night he came back onto television. He's been giving addresses every evening when the curfew has been starting. So he came on TV last night and kind of came up with this huge kind of, there were a lot of areas that he targeted in terms with reforms. So I think from memory, there was a 20% rise in the base pension. The minimum wage rose. So it's about 300,000 pesos at the month, per month at the moment. But that rose to 350,000 as part of a kind of subsidized by the government. Which obviously is going to go some way towards tackling the inequalities that people are really protesting about. I think the electricity rates as well were put back to the same price at the same price that they were at the start of the year. There's a new tax bracket as well, which targeted the kind of top of the pyramid. I think a 40% tax bracket for those earning more than eight million pesos a month, I think. And then kind of more sort of hazier plans as well towards distributing funds between the richer and poorer neighborhoods in Santiago and across the country. So I think they were targeting the right areas, but there's no doubt that these won't kind of appease everybody. There's no way that that what he suggested is a perfect solution, but it's a start. And I think that it was incredibly necessary that he made some kind of declaration to that extent, because I think that what he showed more than anything was that he's understood, or his government are understanding whether they weren't understanding in the first place is debatable anyway, but they're finally kind of getting the message that people are annoyed about a whole host of things, and kind of announcing such a wide range of reforms, I think perhaps is the first step on towards kind of redressing the kind of social contract here in Chile.
Inequality certainly seems to be the key issue here in Chile. How difficult is it for someone born into a lower income neighborhood to move up in Chile's world?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. I think that I don't have the statistics exactly, and there have been a huge number of studies done on this, kind of social mobility and things in Chile. But what people really talk about here is the lack of dignity that people living in these kind of poorer areas really have in the system that Chile has at the moment. People are really, really angry, and it's not just about kind of this, you know, kind of access to capital and being able to buy kind of consumable goods. I think in Latin America, inequality is quite an interesting phenomenon, and all across the world, in that people who kind of, you know, are in these kind of lower socioeconomic percentiles or deciles, so if you go to these poor areas, you'll often see kind of satellite dishes and things, and people have satellite TV, people have smartphones and things, but that's not kind of what people want. That's not the be all and end all. And I don't think that kind of saying that you've got these consumable goods is enough for people anymore. It's access to services, access to healthcare, greater kind of parity between neighborhoods, between social classes, and there's just this kind of this whole kind of notion that's built over such a long time that people who have like huge resources in Chile, and people here really do, some people do, just aren't understanding those that don't, and aren't understanding the circumstances that people live in. So I think inequality goes beyond kind of purely economic inequality, and it's a kind of access to kind of the benefits of society as well, which people are really, really upset about.
Demographics obviously play a key role in political change. How significant of a portion of the overall population are those in their teens or early 20s in Chile?
I think in terms of these protests, there's a lot of them. I think that the Metro Fair Rise was started by secondary school, high school students in Santiago, and that kind of spread to university students and so on and so forth. So I think that, like I said at the start, the way Chilean society is, the young people here have always had an incredible voice. They're very well organized. In 2011, there were very kind of identifiable leaders who are now kind of opposition Congress people who are really starting to make waves in Congress, albeit there's criticism of the opposition here and their reaction to this current crisis at the moment. But I think that there's always a kind of incredibly kind of politicized base within universities and within around young people, which is something that I'm not sure about the US, but certainly in the UK, we just don't really have. And I think that people, I don't know if people in the UK understand that about Chile and the people that are kind of following what's going on, but people here are kind of students are very keen to join political kind of youth movements, and people often identify by the kind of politics that they choose to follow at university. So it's certainly interesting that that kind of aspect of Chilean society, I think that's something that's really important towards understanding this kind of protest as well, that young people are so politicized here.
How do young people in Chile view their future? Are they optimistic or perhaps a bit more pessimistic?
I think that it's I can't speak for all of them, but I've seen a lot of kind of signs around with people referring to the debts they're going to leave university with. I think debt's a huge issue here at the moment, and that's something that really needs to be addressed. I'm not entirely sure how you would do that, but it's something that needs to be really seriously looked at, that people are often kind of running up debts to cover basic living costs to study. I mean, studying here is incredibly expensive, which was the kind of that was the basis of the 2011 movement, and it never really kind of, you know, it never really bore the fruit that people were perhaps hoping for. So I think that that's something else that's going to resurface here as well. But yeah, I think there's a certain pessimism among young people. I think there's optimism at the moment, but I think overall people are still worried about the future. And I think that that's where the I think that's where the protest movement has come from, and the optimism is born from the fact that people think that this could be the moment that things do actually change.
It will certainly be interesting to see how it develops in Chile as the protests continue. John, thank you very much for joining us here on The Crisis Next Door.
No, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
We've been joined by John Bartlett, a journalist based in Santiago, writing for the UK's Guardian newspaper, the BBC, Washington Post, and others, and he's the co-host of Miradas, a podcast focusing on the politics, current events, and culture of Latin America. Thanks for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. Till next time.
The Crisis Next Door with host Jason Brooks is produced weekly.
If you have any thoughts for Jason, email him at tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com. Again, that's tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.